Hello and welcome to Community and University, the MSU Center for Community and Economic Development podcast aimed at providing outreach to both community members and students throughout the state of Michigan. The Michigan State University U.S. Economic Development Administration University Center for Regional Economic Innovation's mission is to stimulate innovative economic development in the most distressed communities within Michigan. The REI University Center embraces a culture of regional collaboration and knowledge sharing between economic development professionals and committed scholars. The center's model provides responsive community engagement, strategic partnerships, and collaborative learning to support the creation and identification of innovative tools, models, and practices to increase the number of small businesses, create access to job skill development, improve public infrastructure, advance high-growth entrepreneurship, and encourage global competitiveness to strengthen underserved communities and historically excluded citizens. The REI University Center's most recent award focuses on four key pillars of community and economic development that together will build up the resilience, sustainability, and equity within the communities in which it partners. The four pillars include resiliency planning, financial resilience, circular economies, and 21st century communications. The University Center will work with community partners to address these themes in Michigan Economic Development Corporation, identified redevelopment-ready communities containing opportunity zone census tracts and or large populations of ALIS, or those who are asset-limited, income-constrained, employed. I'm Emma Gilbert, and I'm one of the hosts for Community and University. Today, we will be spotlighting two of the REI Center's Innovation Fellows, David Palmer and Tony Willis. David is working on a project entitled Growing a Well-Functioning Homebuyer Ecosystem for Low-Median-Income Detroiters. Tony is working on a project entitled Exploring Communal and Cooperative Investment Models for Lansing. Together, both of these projects aim to build financial resilience in the Detroit and Lansing communities. Innovation Fellows provide on-the-ground support and coordination to move these concepts to actions, implementing new economic development tools, models, and policies. Welcome to the CCED podcast, David and Tony.
Thank you for having us.
Good times. Thank you.
So I know both of you guys were previously on a podcast with this REI Center. Today, we're kind of transitioning away from focusing on your individual projects, but more into identifying the intersections in the work that you guys are doing, especially with regard to building up financial resilience in two different communities, but identifying those similarities and differences in which you've encountered in the progression of your work. And so today's conversation will highlight what we will call the democratization of financial resilience. And I'd like to begin just by understanding what democratization as a term means to each of you. So, David or Tony, do you want to start us off?
Well, thank you, David. I guess I'll jump in here. So when I hear the term democratization in relation to economic development tools and programming, it kind of talks about, from my angle, and the title of the project is the communal aspect, where the community has ownership and governance of the resources to help build the prosperity the community deserves and the community believes it needs to have. And so that's where I come, or I believe where democratization fits in my project, why it comes to first to mind in that space. And we'll talk about how both the worker owner cooperative, as well as the community investment trust models, relate to that further in this conversation. But I'd love to hear David's thoughts on that.
So democratization of financial access and resources, I think also encompasses the fact that if everyone has equal access, then the opportunities and challenge matrix changes. Currently, because not everyone is banked or bankable, or because the investor class typically reaps the investment and the rewards, the community is oftentimes left out of those opportunities. So the community investment trust model that Tony just mentioned is particularly interesting when you're looking at redevelopment of a geofenced area. So right, a neighborhood or an entire city or a region, if the residents of those communities gain financial stake through a legal vehicle like a trust, then there's opportunities for more folks to benefit than just the investor class that typically comes in with a plan, executes the plan with some or nominal community input, and then benefits the financial rewards of the plan. So it turns economic development measures as we typically understand them on their head a bit when you can't run through a simple algorithm what the economic impact, in air quotes, would be for the community, because you're not really considering the whole community. You're only considering the limited inputs from the investors and the public sector that is subsidizing, in many cases, the investors to put a number of jobs or a building or a series of buildings in place.
That's wonderful. I think you guys really nailed what democratization means to you, and not just to you, but into the planning profession and community and economic development profession in general. Have you understood from your perspective why this democratization has been maybe on the forefront more now so than it has been in previous years? What might be the motivation behind planners in really trying to drive that point home now than previous to the pandemic?
I think if you want to talk about equity and opportunities and equal protection for addressing resources, and you want to do that with a straight face, then I think you need to be considering the broader participation of the community in these investments. Because ultimately, we're oftentimes talking about public investments in resources, and those resources are not available to the public except in sort of nominally, legally defined ways. So, for example, if you're talking about investing in a sports ball stadium, then you know tens or hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars can be invested into those things. And economic developers have traditionally said, well, it's going to attract all these people and there's going to be this rollover to small businesses. But the folks that live in the neighborhoods deal with the traffic.
Right.
They deal with people not from their community using their community as a playground and all of the benefits and negatives that come from that. And ultimately, you have sports ball players who are receiving tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation from the receipts to gain entry to the stadium and on the TV and all of these things that don't necessarily benefit communities that are even directly adjacent, except through this theoretical exercise of the number of people that show up to a bar or a restaurant, which is important, but it doesn't fundamentally impact the neighbors unless they happen to be a waiter, a waitress, or a small business owner. And even then, that impact is limited to the 10, 50, or 100 engagements a year that occur through that facility. So
I think that's definitely one of the main drivers there for why this type of democratization is happening in the space. That inequality and knowing where values are, the value is, and the access to that value is not had by the majority or many, especially in certain demographics, that has been more prevalent or at least top of mind now in conversation than has been in years past. I think the pandemic, you know, the celestial bodies aligned where additional awakening took place in what's going on, how other folks couldn't deal with the pandemic as well as other people did. And it hurt a lot of people. The majority hurt. Some people prospered, right, in this space. But people that hurt, the suffering wasn't equal suffering. There's some groups in cities and communities that were hit extraordinarily hard. Mm-hmm. Then why is that? You know, this thing across, because it showed that not all cities are treated equally, not all communities are treated equally. And then who decides so how those resources are distributed, right? And who really has that community's best interest at heart? And if it's not attached to the local level to those there that those that live there, those that reside there, on a day in, day out basis, not only just come in for the conference or come in for work and commute out, people actually live there. If they're not really the powers that be that can decide, then there's something going on. And I think David put it perfectly. A lot of time investment skews heavily the amount of involvement, the amount of direction the program grows. And normally, a lot of folks in a lot of communities are not making hundreds of thousands of dollars annually. The median income in America is $67,000, right? So, and that's the median. And, you know, there's a lot of folks that are less than that in that space. So we have to understand how dollars show and dollars create leverage. And unfortunately, a lot of these communities don't have that leverage. So a long-winded way, but I think we're all those things combined and created this additional need as saying local control and authority and at least a voice to be had in the process.
Yeah, so with the research project that I have going on, there's an investment being made by taxpayers in the city of Detroit to rehabilitate about 1,500 homes. And those homes all happen to be in neighborhoods with very low probability that they will gain a mortgage to be purchased. So normal humans looking to buy a house are not likely to be the people that are going to be purchasing these properties if the system continues as it is. So we're, by extrapolation, supporting the investor community through tax subsidies, and in this case, hundreds of millions of dollars that were bonded by taxpayers through the city. And if we want normal humans to get access to those properties, i.e. democratization of capital and public investment, then we need to have programs and indeed interventions that allow for that marketplace to be established. Because the bricks and mortar lenders and online lenders of the world are very, very unlikely to make a loan to a median income Detroiter who's making $30,000 to $35,000 a year in their household to renovate a home that the city has already put in place. So just because we've always done economic development in a certain method doesn't mean that that can't change to be responsive to the evolving needs of the community. And the democratization of access to capital through community capital, impact investing, and indeed leveraging the once in three generation opportunity we have with the ARPA investments that are in our communities. If we don't think about how to do that in a very specific way that benefits our neighbors, then those dollars will be piddled away through program management consultants and limited impact projects that will come to fruition over the next couple of years. So it's a rare window of opportunity to influence the way that capital is distributed through the public sector to actually benefit the public rather than a very narrow band of investment class organizations and individuals, which often very happen to be the wealthy Caucasian class in this country. So if we want to make sure that dollars and investments make it further into communities of color, then we need to engage in those communities and determine what those communities actually want on the ground versus what they're voluntold by the political and municipal management class.
Yeah, I want to jump on that for David. I love how you said the way as the profession of economic development must always keep its finger to the pulse of the community and the local economy. And the tools that worked at that generation or at that point in time doesn't mean they'll always be the same moving forward, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the game changes, and that's the change is the only constant here. Mm-hmm. And whether it's us changing it or it's being forced upon us some way, you have to adapt, you have to, you know, step up and meet the need and meet the call of duty at that point in time to do the job and profession, its justice and the community, the respect they deserve in that space. Along those lines, when we think of how the wealth building mechanisms of America, I look at, and this word kind of comes to my project, both when ownership of real estate. In business, the entity or the organizational structure of a business are two major wealth generating asset classes that for the long period of time in the United States history, Black people have not been able to actually participate in, especially in the housing market, right? And there's been tons of statistical data and evidence that show the long-standing effects that has from the GI Bill and the lack of Black people being accepted or approved in that space. And that was a, you know, one of the big boasters and boosters of the economy, because your home continued to grow and that home is now owned. And then when Black people were allowed to buy homes, it was in certain areas, right? You're only allowed to buy homes in an area that the system allowed you to buy homes in. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a free for all. And that was never, you could buy a house in this location, next to the plant, next to the pollution. I mean, that was the thing, right? You can get to work early on time because you live right there. That is the case, as we know. And it's kind of like, if you say it like this, like, wow.
Yeah.
But that's a part of it. And then when it comes to ownership, the game is already being played. The chessboard is already in motion. And if I'm already playing a game and it's already in motion, maybe chess is not the best analogy, but whatever game we're thinking that there's characters on the board and there's things happening and the hand is already being set. And I say, hey, I'm going to jump in the game now. Where do I start? You can't start this. The playing field is no longer the same as once it once started. So you have to think of, how do I interject new tactics to allow the new participant a chance to participate in what's already taking place. Mm-hmm. If not, why even bother? It's just lip service. You're just there for cannon fodder at that point. So if I were really allowing you a roll or a special card to flip that'll make you jump 20 spaces, or it has to be something there that make it even worth your, like, really to get into the game. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so both when I look at the community investment trust model, it's a way that the community, not just, you know, tied to the Black people, but the community of maybe an impoverished area, that's by our lack of invested area, the community can own a property and own a piece of commercial real estate that can be a wealth building tool. And also they can help control and dictate what goes in that space. You know, maybe they don't want another payday advance loan space or another liquor store in that community. Yeah, you know, like, those are things that you don't have to be there. That's very generic, but you go to a lot of strip malls, a lot of certain locations, those are prevalent, right? Then the worker owner succession planning is that a lot of employees might not even think that they're in a position to own a business. But they probably, if they do the job, we've done the job for over a decade or years and years, you know your job. You probably have a good understanding of what's going on in the business itself. Mm-hmm. How can we position that where they can have a succession plan, a collectively take ownership from the current owner? Because just like most Americans, most businesses don't have succession plans. What happens when I'm ready to retire, right?
Yeah.
And so both these, you know, ideas and projects here are really grounded in getting folks the access into both generating tools that have been long for many of folks have not been had access to, and others might even think they even can achieve that. So
building on the game analogy is, imagine you're a player that comes to a game of Monopoly where all the properties are already purchased. Mm-hmm. But if you expanded the Monopoly board by 30 or 40% and put new properties in place, and those properties were first targeted to folks that didn't have assets in play, then I think you're talking about inviting players to the game that they're going to be however many steps behind players that were already in the game. But now they at least have a way to get their foot in the door to establish a stake and earn resources off of the new properties that come onto the board. So if we're talking about the project that I'm working on in Detroit, where we're focused on first further developing the home buyer education system to allow for more thoughtful data collection and braided resources for program participants from the perspective of the education provider who is themselves under-resourced in the game. And then, all right, so now you've got educated home buyers creating a demand metric for a resource that has very limited availability. So in this situation, the resource that's limited available is move-in ready single family homes, whereby investments have already been made by the public sector into bringing some of these homes up to speed. So getting them finished has traditionally been, we'll throw it over the fence to the investor class for whatever they're willing to pay for it at quote market rate, end quote. Here, the intervention would allow for nonprofit community development organizations to gain access to those properties, bring those properties up to certificate of occupancy with new furnace, new kitchen, new bathrooms, flooring. So who's going to do all that work? Well, we have an awful lot of resources available for workforce training programs. And we also have a deficiency of folks that know how to leverage skilled trades as their point of employment. So you begin braiding in these additional public sector resources, which are going to get spent anyway. Mm-hmm. Why not focus it on a program that allows a pathway to home ownership for individuals that invested time, energy, and dollars into becoming more informed about how to participate in that process? Because mm-hmm. Example, when I list a home for sale in the city of Detroit, I will oftentimes geofence social media advertising to about a half mile radius around the house. Most people move less than 10 miles mm-hmm. to their new place of living.
Right.
So I want to be able to try to advertise and communicate directly to the neighbors that are adjacent to this house who may be interested in buying a home in their own neighborhood. 95% of those communications that come back to me ask me if there is a land contract or a rent-to-own option to purchase this property. And as I sort of ask questions about why that would be their preferred method of acquisition, almost inevitably, the answer is, I can't get a mortgage because of list of reasons. Mm-hmm. And right. those reasons are essentially that not that you can't get a mortgage, it's that you don't know how, because no one in your family has ever had one. And the only means to acquisition that you're familiar with are these payday lending for home purchases, mm-hmm. i.e. Not friendly land contracts for the buyer, or rent-to-own schemes, which are really leases that include a very long opportunity, yes. like hitting the numbers. If you play your daily four, you know, once every 25 years, you'll probably hit your numbers.
Right.
Right. But right. in this case, you're playing that high stakes gambling opportunity with where you live.
Yeah.
So if these resources became acquainted, available, and socialized within larger communities, that don't have access to these resources. And this is one way to expand that game board to allow for opportunity in areas where the public's already investing and you know you have a demand established for obtaining these opportunities. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it and do just napkin math over a 30-year period, the $250 million that would be invested into building a factory that might yield 5,000 jobs, but would probably only yield 1,800 jobs, is one way to go about doing it from an economic development perspective. Or do you provide opportunities for home ownership to individuals that would be paying about $7,000 less in mortgage versus rent, and over a 30-year period, putting $300 million into the pockets of your neighbors rather than a multinational corporation that shares its wealth with its shareholders?
True. Very true. And not just, and to your point, not just people in Detroit, for example, not having a family member who's ever gotten a loan, but also building those social networks that are extremely important to understanding what opportunities you do have to increase your, you know, economic position as an individual or within your family in general.
Yeah. Yeah. A quality education is directly correlated to a established and growable social network. Is I think an awful lot of people network their way into better jobs throughout their lives because of the access to social capital that is earned through primary, secondary, and post-secondary education.
Yep.
Not having those access points, you know, denies you the ability to learn from your parents around the dining room table about what it takes to make the mortgage payment every month, or to be at a social event or a golf outing or a whatever, where the person that's in front of you that can do the thing that everyone's looking for a resource for gets that opportunity. It doesn't get posted to Indeed.com. So these are the types of pathways that ultimately build capital and democratize access to information and resources in communities, regardless of their color palette.
Yeah, you just don't know because you just don't know. And you really, because you just don't have access to that. If you were that education puts you in a position, you're that first person to go to college, right? And your family. Now you're in a room with other individuals who might not be the first person to go to college. And you're hearing from their experiences. You're like, hold on, what's going on? Her lifestyle is this way and his lifestyle is that. You glean information from that social network that you have there in real life, and you bring that home like, I think I'll be doing this wrong. We could be doing it this way. Or I heard this works over here. And because you're now introduced and exposed to new concepts that just weren't there for you at point in time. You know what I mean? It's like, that's how you do that. You mean I can just refinance this and pull equity out of my car and pay for that instead of getting a whole other unsecured loan? Yeah. I could do what? That's not a thought to some folks. And across the board, I can actually own a property or my credit score. You know, people have that fear of things. And it's like that more knowledge helps alleviate the fear of the unknown. And access to the social capital is definitely a part of that big time. I just want to say that, David. That's a brilliant thought, and that should be noted for sure.
So democratization of access to capital is not just cash money.
Right.
It's goodwill. It's social networks. It's the connections that we have in society that allow us to navigate the ups and downs that everybody goes through. So in going back to, you know, Tony's project where he's looking at a community investment trust in Lansing, you know, organically, we're looking at the same thing in Detroit. So I'm working with a large group of community development organizations and others applying for a United Way of Southeastern Michigan grant, whereby we're looking at a neighborhood called East Chadsey-Condon, which is a small subset of the Chadsey-Condon neighborhood in Detroit. And there happens to be about 1,000 vacant lots or properties in a fairly small area of the city. But the neighbors that are there, we all believe should benefit and have strong input into how their community becomes redeveloped.
Right.
Due to its proximity to some pretty major investments by multinational companies in the city, eventually the investor class will see large tracts of land and want to put in market rate condominiums and single family properties. That is just the way the markets work when there's demand and opportunity and the pro forma shows that they can make some money. As a real estate broker, this math is pretty straightforward. But if the intervention occurs before all that gets gobbled up by interest groups and the community then becomes an owner in their own opportunity, then perhaps the community could literally benefit from those investments that turn into new housing and could also prioritize the purchase point of some of these properties so that it becomes accessible for neighbors rather than folks with a lot more resources that are probably coming from somewhere else. So this model of looking at community investment trusts is one way to allow neighborhoods to a stronger right to self-determination. Rather than having to show up in a reactionary fashion to a planning committee or a zoning board of appeals or a whatever it is, where lawyers show up on the side that wants to do something and normal humans show up with limited 2-minute talking point opportunities to public bodies that are about to dramatically change their way of life.
Yeah, that's a lot right there, David. You put that, because that private corporation entity is paying somebody a large amount of money full-time to do this work while you are a community member working, family, this, that. And now you got to jump in here and say, whoa, what's going on? At that point, the ship has already left.
Yes.
And you're yelling like, whoa, they might put the anchor back down. They're not. The wind's at their sail. It's time to keep going. And, you know, best thing you can do is hope and pray somebody might be conscious enough to say, Mike, let's think about that for a second. But that's a low probability chance. I want to say this when it comes to furthering the point. It's all about individuals having that self-determination in the community and seeing it grow into a way where they can live out. They, as the current residents, can see a growth strategy where they are winning as well, right? Not being displaced, not being put out or being bought out for something that's not really the value to only be marked up dramatically once they are out of there. You know, it has to be looked at where people can, who are currently there, can grow and have thrive and see opportunities for themselves. When we think of the community investment trust model in our area, it's mostly in the Lansing community. We think of, there's a number of spots on South Lansing here. Logan Square is a big commercial property. It's like, if you ever Google Maps, it's a giant concrete, it's literally a massive mall, strip mall.
I was gonna say, for listeners who maybe aren't pulling up a picture of this location, it's pretty much like a, more leaning towards like a vacant strip mall at this point, correct?
Oh, yeah.
With a large parking area that really surrounds the whole complex.
Big time. I'd probably say, if I were just to guesstimate how many, maybe 12 to 25 acres of concrete and spaceage, you know, in my mind, of how between the property itself and the asphalt concrete parking space. So like I said, it's a large area.
Yeah.
And majority vacant. And but then, as we mentioned earlier, this is part of somebody's portfolio management of other properties. That person or company that lives here or that owns the property doesn't live here. Right. That's out of sight, out of mind. And if this was not performing, is it really hurting me that much? Do I really want to put in an effort to it? I got other properties that are performing better. I deal with that when I deal with it. And then while the local residents, the inhabitants, have to deal with it on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And I think it further goes to the point that we have to act in a way that is probably new, because it is once a generation, as David mentioned. You know, I was having maybe 3 to 4 times previously in the inception of the United States, where this much money influx has come in at once. I think the social climate, as well as the political backing to do some projects like this, are kind of still in line. They're kind of going out of alignment now. I think they're heightened probably mid-2020 to late or early 2021. But this time is still now to engage in this space. And it should always still be both. We should still look to attract the big projects that, you know, but as well, equally has to be put in the effort of growing the local communal infrastructure to create prosperity on a local level in that space.
So small businesses and small investors drive this national economy. Despite the attention that the Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 or Fortune 50 receive, you know, they have disproportionate influence on the narrative of how dollars are invested and spent. So when we think about previous REI projects to the center, we've looked at community capital, we've looked at impact investing, we've looked at a whole range of democratization of investment vehicles, because about 97% of all of the investment dollars that are put in our retirement portfolios go straight to Wall Street, right? Yeah. So you imagine peeling off 1, 2, or 3% of the endowment of Michigan State University or the University of Michigan or the Wayne State University or the Michigan Pension Trust Fund or the Natural Resources Trust Fund. a 3% peel off of those billions of dollars would yield $1.1 billion in opportunity to invest in our communities. So these are the types of opportunities for democratization that could occur, because really, normal human investors like us, I will presume that none of us have a net worth over $1 million, and that we would be amongst the investor class that goes to a retail investment advisor to tell us how to split up our portfolio and send it all to Wall Street. Well, if we had community capital options, whereby there were a secondary market to trade in the purchase and equity options within small business communities, we would then begin to circulate our dollars more locally. Yep. So using cooperatives as a vehicle for succession planning will work for a slice of the business community. Another slice of the business community may be able to sell their shares to Jane and Joe and Dishandra and Jimmy within the community, who want to invest in the local mechanic shop or the bakery or the software startup. So making these options available in the marketplace is really what the REI Center's research and their fellows have been focused on for a number of years. And the projects that we're working on now, I think, begin to look at operationalizing solutions based on the more theoretical frameworks that have been, you know, written about and fill the shelves in our library. So thinking about how to, you know, democratize access to investments, capital, real estate, business ownership, et cetera, is really where our projects are going, building on the progress that have been made by fellows previously.
I mean, as you previously mentioned in a previous comment and just now, traditionally, you know, community engagement has been a core feature of planning, and not just planning in theory, but planning in practice as well, especially at the municipal level. But how does democratization or the process of democratization really go beyond the efforts towards community engagement that are traditionally seen in exercises like creating a master plan or community visioning exercises for creating a corridor improvement authority, for example? You know, what makes the actual outcome of these democratization processes different than simply asking for, you know, community input, for example, or not just community input, but, you know, actually having an exercise where they engage in creating the idea that will eventually be implemented?
So the proof will be in the long-term wealth accumulation. So ancestors that look like me got subsidized to leave Detroit and other urban areas to move into freshly built suburban homes and communities that ancestors that looked like Tony didn't have an opportunity to buy. He mentioned that earlier, simple fact. It was called redlining, steering, blockbusting. There's all kinds of terms that were tried and true from the federal government, the real estate community, and the lending community that separated resources in a apartheid light implementation in the Detroit region, the Lansing region, and really urban communities around the country. To really drive a stake into it, when the interstate highway systems were built, almost all those highways got built right through Black and brown communities. So more displacement. The landowners of those communities were folks that were Caucasian, and they benefited from the sale of the property to the government or got opportunities to build new developments for the people that were displaced, who also didn't have ownership there. So when we think about the democratization, when the dollars start circulating locally, and normal humans who are assumed not to be a part of the wealth building conversation are now included and start to earn incremental improvements over time, then the chart for Caucasians after World War II and intergenerational wealth transfers goes slightly upwards and dips a couple times through recessions and then recovers and keeps going up, where everybody else stays at pretty low and then falls off and then maybe recovers a little bit, but keeps going downward. So when those long-term trends start shifting because folks are making improvements in their lives off of the access to opportunity, capital, real estate, business ownership, et cetera, then we'll know we'll be successful. So just like anything, if it's in the budget and you're measuring the outcomes that you want to see in your budget, then we need to be measuring outcomes to benefit communities that have traditionally been locked out of opportunity.
Yeah, I think that was a great question too, Emma, and great answer there, David. You're right, community engagement happens often, right? Let's hear from the community. That in itself, and what does that tell us? That we're only hearing doesn't mean we're going to have to listen. We're going to perceive, hear, get some type of understanding, maybe. But
it's more like a facially kind of beneficial type of program in terms of community engagement.
Yeah.
But the actual outcome.
Yeah,
it's truly not.
It should be community-based decision making, right? That's where we're right. Not community engagement. Engagement, yeah, we're going to engage them. If I play for my kid, I'm engaging my kid. It doesn't mean he's going to impact what I decide for dinner that night. I'm engaging with what we're going to do, right? That's a way of engagement.
Yeah.
But I'm still going to pick the menu out and make this. That's what I feel like a lot of happens here. We'll engage them. Your voice is heard. You know, we're talking to you.
Yeah.
But all right, now when it's time for the big kids patching the head, and I want to make the call.
Yeah, choose from the three options that we've already predetermined are palatable for us.
Right.
Yes.
And then now you've had your input. Now, do we want to go back to direct democracy and have votes on every single thing? No, that's not practical or reasonable. But I think we can look at legal and commercial vehicles to be inclusive of areas that are seeking redevelopment, especially if those communities have traditionally not been at the table for opportunity.
Yeah, there's so many ways, and it's all about being, you have to open it up to possibilities, right? To try something and see where it goes. That is the human condition, right? Humans create a lot more things. All the factories and the pollutants we're trying to figure out now to build, we create more things and think of the solutions after it affects us. Like, oh, now we got to think of a solution to it. Nobody thinks so. I feel like from that vantage point, if we are talking about real community-led decision-making or incorporated thoughts, let's break that down. All right, here are our main elected officials. That's one thing. Here are the project leads. Here are these organizations. Who from this community, from this zip code, this neighborhood, who's being heard from that specifically? Somebody in that realm, right? And if there's an actual, like not somebody who's adjacent, who used to live there, because that's the thing. Yeah, that's the past you. The current you is not there, right? Who's currently in that space right now that can be that voice? And then not just that person, but number of folks, which that person has a position to really push change this way or that way, where the entire group must understand and see what's coming from. And that's more aligned to actual decision-making than just the engagement. Do you think this work out well? Like, yeah. And then, because I get it, we can't go, everybody has a vote in that space. Maybe in the future we can. Technology might take us to a place like that, you know?
If we had instant runoff voting to solve for the duopoly system of tribal warfare that manages our politics, then you might be able to get to that point.
Oops, sorry, red side. You know, yeah, exactly. But that's the fact, though. I feel like as things progress, we have to be progressive within our tools, our operations to meet the need as community changes. And as you said, in the monopoly board here, how do we expand and let other people that had not had entry access have ability to catch up and play the current board game at the current status as it is right now?
So I think one of the things we haven't really talked about, though, in this space is how politics are involved in this process. Now, we're all pretty fairly aware that things have to be politically, they seem like a benefit to the political body in which governs either the municipality or like a smaller unit of government, like the, for example, a corridor improvement authority, just that's the top of mind. But there is always some kind of governing body over the larger decision-making processes, like you previously talked about, you know, how do we get people in the door in order to not only engage with them, but to actually include them in that process. So how, you know, do we move beyond truly, you know, inviting people to make a public comment for 2 minutes on an issue like this, but truly involving them and listening to them, not just listening, but, you know, mobilizing on their feedback in terms of what they want, because that is definitely something that has been a political issue. And it will probably continue to be a political issue, but there's got to be some kind of inroad to breaking down that barrier in politicians that don't really truly want to incorporate community members' input in their, you know, decisions.
I'm going to jump in with this one, David. This is one idea here. It kind of, the politics, there's a part there, but I also think that, you know, somebody is elected and they make X promises, X, Y, and Z. That's, I hear that. I think it's on the community needs to create its own standard of what that development looks like in their space. And the elected official should adhere to what that standard has already been set. And this is an example. This is a complete novel idea. I'm still got this right now. I'm not sure if it could be existed in other places, but here we go. Imagine a community. Let's say North Lansing. So that's the South Lansing, we'll say North Lansing. North Lansing, the communal roundtable ahead of time says, we want, if we have a project that's coming in for this dollar amount and incentives are being looked at this project, in order for it to be here, we need these three things to be prioritized as a communal investment in this space. Mm-hmm. Then, whoever elected official is, has the mandate or standard that that geography needs when it comes to dealing with a project. The EDO does, the planning, the chamber, whoever is involved. These are our standards, this community here. And when you say, and now granted, then that opens opportunity to say, I can't have this project go through without these things being met. And then the project, the corporation or the project says, well, I'm not sure about that. Then it allows for negotiation. And the community can then have a real say on how much the community wants or values those standards versus having this elected official who doesn't really know, because you're most of the officials have a large swath of area they're overseeing. Mm-hmm. Each, and that's a lot of different neighborhoods and different desires and needs and wants. And really have, you know, that localized level, this community needs this. And if you want this deal to happen here or XYD, this project to take place, we need to either meet these as is, or I need to now involve that community and say, hey, they want to do this project, but can't do these things here. And then the community can determine if they want to negotiate or not to some degree. So
if I solve for lowest common denominator for the question, which is essentially the politics that overlay this situation, I see three buckets. I see the political class, I see policy and local implementation, and then I see vehicles that interact with the first two. So from the political side, I'm not aware of any corporation or entity in the state of Michigan that has a $60 billion budget where you can have no more than 4 years of experience to be the key decision maker.
Yeah.
That is the Michigan House of Representatives.
Yeah.
And the Michigan State Senate is similarly inclined with very short time span,
yeah,
very limited experience, and very limited depth into many policy areas. So that bucket can be changed through the state constitution, through direct action, and then organic legislative changes. And the policy bucket in the middle is the policies that municipalities and local entities or quasi-governmental organizations interact with to do business. So the EDO that Tony mentioned is Economic Development Organization, and there are EDOs all across the state with different geographies and focus areas. Mm-hmm. You have local clerks and municipal structures or townships or counties, and they have zoning ordinances and all kinds of different things that folks need to adhere to in order to be able to mm-hmm. do development. So that would be the 2 minutes of speaking time that is reactionary to something that's already been proposed.
Yeah.
The third piece is the vehicle by which you engage with those things. So a community investment trust or a co-op or a corporation or a nonprofit organization are all legal vehicles by which you can do real estate development or sell widgets or whatever it is that you're passionate about and do to make resources. So when you have a community investment trust that becomes the landowner of a particular area, and the trustees of that trust happen to be the neighbors that live within the community, mm-hmm. now they are organized under an umbrella that allows them to engage differently with the policy folks and the political folks, mm-hmm. right? So they're engaging in a similar way as a for-profit corporation or even a nonprofit corporation would engage with those structures. So it's whether it's a co-op or a trust or a nonprofit entity, you know, banding together these resources allows the opportunity to have conversations and make investments at a different scale than most people can do as individuals with limited time, resources, and expertise. So if we want to fix any one of the three buckets or change them over time, as the conversation has alluded to, then it's really upon the population to band together to say, these are the things that we want to see as outcomes from these investments. And do you band together in a vehicle like a trust or a corporation? Or do you band together behind one or more political candidates that are willing to carry that water to the firing squad that you have in Lansing? Or do you organize locally and try to influence your municipal calendar and schedule and priorities? Ultimately, in the state of Michigan, the legislature over especially the last 30 years has hamstrung individual communities in their ability to band together in different ways, as has happened in other states. So you can't do things like rent control in cities. You can't have municipally owned broadband systems because the Michigan Telecommunications Act was amended to say that municipalities can't participate unless they jump through all these hoops first. So there's all kinds of barriers to collective engagement that have been sort of chopped off at the knees by forward-thinking lobbyists that have influenced amateurs that run our state legislature. So if we want to organize as communities, trust vehicles like Tony is working on, or nonprofit corporations, or even traditional corporations, are ways that neighbors can band together to influence and survive within the frameworks that we have created for ourselves.
I mean, one of the things you just briefly touched upon was the fact that in politics, a lot of the times these private entities or these private businesses have more say due to the fact that they have money, right? Mm-hmm. These businesses, as you know, Citizens United decision in 2010 ruled, you know, have the ability to engage in political elections. Okay, so now we have people competing against businesses or corporate incentives, basically in politics. So I think that what you're saying is wonderful, but like, how do people like really truly overcome that barrier? I think, you know, relying on EDOs as entities, maybe, or not EDOs, I should say, but economic development entities outside of specific municipal government, like LEAP, for example, is not specifically tied to the city of Lansing, but serves in a similar capacity to the economic development, you know, department within the city government. Like, how do those interactions with other types of organizations that are not specifically tied to a local entity or maybe even a regional entity get mobilized in terms of trying to have that collective support and mobilizing these things forward, right?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I've seen a number of grassroots efforts, probably you guys too, David, in this space. Mm-hmm. There's one group, Community Education Economic Development Group, the SEED, is it goes by, they kind of house, are they local, are they meet in the Logan Square Plaza on a monthly basis, in fact, weekly for different type of educational workshops when it comes to economic and community education development in that space.
Yeah.
Local grassroots group, not a formed organization yet in that space, but how we pivot them to be that, mm-hmm. and give them some control, authority, thought process, leadership on that community, in that space, where then that group, whether it's not formed yet or formed, can interact with Philippe directly in the way, or at least have a direct contact or in that space, as well as with the city or any other major partner when it comes to economic or business development in those spaces. There comes both the formation on the local level, but then we have to create as organizations, mm-hmm. the inputs where they can incorporate them into us. We have to, they are saying, hey, we are here, and how can I incorporate that to my structure?
Right.
And because that, once that's really incorporated, we value that membership. They're not just a thing out there. They're a part of it now.
Yeah.
Whether that's having the seat at the board, there has to be some directive. Those are just some ways, but it's a larger conversation we're getting at. And I definitely understand that.
I guess I was just trying to get at how that networking opportunity is part of building the social capital that we had previously talked about, because a lot of the things we're discussing have systemic or institutional barriers involved, mm-hmm. in them, which is prominent in any discussion about equity building or, you know, building resilience in underserved communities. But I guess that comment was really just to show that although you can mobilize as a grassroots organization or as a neighborhood association, building that social capital with other entities that are not just the local government, but, you know, other nonprofits, for example, is another inroads to really mobilizing yourself forward in that process of trying to get inroads to decision making.
It's a discussion as old as the Republic.
Right.
Right. So how do you, you know, organize? Community organizing is what you're really getting to.
Yeah.
And how do you organize resources, knowledge, expertise, and assets to be able to move the needle on a topic? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the third bucket that I was talking about that Tony is working on, the Community Investment Trust, is one way to organize under an entity that can own assets and have a soapbox, a collective soapbox to reach out. Because if, you know, this community in Lansing or in Detroit or in Flint or Benton Harbor or Pawpaw or wherever it is, you know, those community members choose to get together and they're working with a common agenda and voice, then that's a really powerful way to gain the attention and provide leadership pathways. To have the system become slightly more responsive to the positions that you hold. Ultimately, you know, if the systems that we have built and maintained through state law and constitutional constraints that we have in place are too cumbersome, then perhaps it's time to consider reestablishing the way we choose to do business with each other as Michiganians. So in 2026, there'll be a question on everyone's ballot, would you like to hold a constitutional convention? So a state constitution asks voters every 16 years if you'd like to hold a constitutional convention to reestablish the ways that we all choose to work together under our system of government in this state. And I think reasonable arguments can be made that Now is actually a pretty good time to consider holding a constitutional convention and determining how we all want to live together in this civil society in the 21st century moving forward. Because we haven't had that sort of hard grown-up conversation since the early 1960s. And I dare say that life has changed a wee bit since, since the early 1960s. And, you know, perhaps we as a society are actually ready to become our better selves. And we should have governing documents that reflect that. So all of these things are big. And yes, they will take time, effort, and energy. But I think that the commons are worth that time and investment. And if we start with small projects like trying to figure out how to get 1,500 homes in the city of Detroit that are being invested in by the city into the hands of normal humans rather than investors, or you look at 25 acres of concrete jungle in Lansing that could be transformed into a beautiful place for residents where residents actually benefit. You know, these are both sort of small ways to take those steps. The macro ways need to be thought about as well. And we desperately need, you know, leaders to step up and think about, you know, reestablishing the rules of engagement for the 21st century.
That was a wonderful way to really, truly close off the larger conversation we're having, not just about democratization at this point, but about really, truly kind of rethinking the systems by which we operate as a state, you know, and as a nation. So there's definitely a lot to digest in what we just talked about. But I think that this is a good place for us to kind of tie off what we've talked about. We've gone really in a full range of things from community engagement to, you know, financial resilience itself and everything in between. On behalf of the CCVA office, I should say, I would like to personally thank both of you for joining me today and having this conversation. I think talking about things that are uncomfortable is one of the ways that we can make important conversations less taboo. Break down that wall and providing more accessible language to really discuss these items and not just, you know, having a theoretical perspective put forth, but, you know, one that can be in practice and built upon too. Again, on behalf of the center, we truly look forward to you guys completing your research and presenting what you find at the REI Summit this summer. And with that, we'll see you next time with another REI Innovation Fellow or Project Leader. So thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.